Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Mike Campbell, and I've enjoyed giving you the story behind the song here on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to the story behind the song. I'm your host, Peter Chatti of Deep Cuts Media, and we are back for season 4. Hard to believe, but our little musical journey launched nearly 4 years ago, and now here we are with over 60 great legendary artist interviews in the can. All of them are icons and innovators, and their stories are classic and timeless. You can revisit them anytime. But to kick things off fast and furiously for season 4, I have a very special one. Legendary guitarist, vocalist, and songwriter Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, one of the great American bands of all time. Mike and Tom formed the band in the mid-1970s and played together for nearly 50 years, writing countless classic songs together every step of the way, including the song Refugee from their 1979 album Damn the Torpedoes. You'll love the journey he takes us on in the interview, his insider stories that you can't find anywhere else, and his memories he shares of Tom. And that's what the story behind the song is all about. It's about digging deep with legendary artists who tell their stories about their most iconic songs in their own words, who take us on their personal musical journey, and who share their deeply personal and frequently raw stories of their lives that you can't find anyplace else. I created this podcast to ask great artists questions that, like you, I've always wanted to ask, and then to dig even deeper to ask questions others have never asked. Because I know their music, respect their work, love the artistry of it all. And yes, I'm a fan, just like you. So let's go and kick things off for season 4 by diving deep into the story behind the song Refugee with the legendary Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
So Mike, you are a true musician's musician. I think that was the first time I've ever said that to anybody in my 50 plus 60 interviews. And it's really true. And the just the legends, you yourself and your storied background and all you've done, but all the legends with whom you've worked, including Don Henley, Stevie Nicks, so many, you know, I can't even name them all. Obviously, you joined Fleetwood Mac for a period of time, too, in the fairly recent years. But I got to go through a couple of the litany of things. One, you're obviously with Tom Petty and all the things you've done, one of the most iconic rock and roll bands of all time, inducted into the Hall of Fame on your first year of eligibility. I don't even know how many albums you sold, but it's a lot. But today, as I said, we're going to get into Refugee, the story behind that, and your book. Wanted to understand how you got into music in the first place, just your personal journey as a kid growing up in Florida.
Yeah,
how that all happened, and then how that led you to meeting Tom and forming Mudcrutch.
I was a kid of the '60s, and my dad was really into Johnny Cash and Elvis, and so he played those records a lot around the house. And I was enthralled with the guitar playing. I don't know what it was, but I just wanted to get a guitar really bad. And then, of course, the Beatles came along, the Ed Sullivan Show and all that, and changed everybody's minds. And I begged and begged until I got a guitar. And so that's what turned me on, really, was Scotty Moore and Luther Perkins from Elvis and Johnny Cash's bands. And then, of course, the British Invasion and the Beach Boys, all that stuff. It was a great time to be a musician starting out because it was a renaissance of great music and great guitar players.
Yeah.
And that's where I came from.
Yeah. And So you mentioned some of your influences. Were there any other guitarists who just rocked your face off and you just knew that, like, that's what I want to be?
Yeah. Michael Bloomfield from the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. Back then there were no rock magazines. All there was Downbeat, which is kind of a jazz magazine, but they had a blues section, and I read a review about the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, and I went and got that first record, and I wore it out. I just loved the guitar on it. Yeah. It was miles beyond what I could imagine learning how to do, but I tried to learn it off the records, and I loved the way he played. He was a huge inspiration to me. And to a lesser degree, Jerry Garcia, I loved the way he played, his scales and the heart that he played with. So those two, aside from the British invasion, those would be the two that would pop into my mind first.
And so growing up in Florida, how did you meet Tom, and how did that lead you to forming the first band, Mudcrutch?
Well, Mudcrutch already existed. I had seen a first version of Mudcrutch, which included Tom Petty and Tom Ledden. And at the university, at an outdoor park there. And I thought they were good. And so one thing led to another, and Tom and Mudcrutch ended up coming out to the farmhouse where I was living with my drummer to audition him. And it just turned out they needed a guitar player at that same day, and I was in the back room, so I went out and sat in, and my path was set.
It's amazing how these happened, how the stories.
It is. Like it is that. Amazing. You know, it's magical. You know, your life goes through so many people you meet and paths that you cross and choices you make where you could go left or right.
Yeah,
that will determine your whole life, you know, and that was just one of those things that I guess it was some sort of destiny that we were supposed to hook up together and have a musical dream, you know.
Did it feel like when you first met each other, you guys were so young, so I don't even know if you have that kind of feeling at the time, but did you feel like you had something special?
Me personally or me and Tom?
No, just you personally, and then you and Tom when you came together and had that moment where you joined the band.
Well, speaking for myself, you know, I was just very naive about it all. I knew I could play the guitar. I knew that I had some affinity to it because I knew as soon as I started playing, girls would come up and talk to me.
Yeah.
And they never would before. So I knew I had some ability there that I wanted to you know, go after.
Right.
And when I met Tom, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. It's just like, we just liked each other. We liked the same kinds of music. We were wanting to write the same types of songs. And I just felt like I'd known him my whole life. Like he'd listened to all the same records I'd listened to and dreamed the same dreams I'd been dreaming about being a musician. And I didn't know where it was going to lead, but I just knew I like this guy. I like hanging out with him, and I'd like to work on some music with him.
Yeah, no, very cool. And so then you had your journey with Mudcrutch, which was a couple years, as I understand it, and then there was a break for a little bit. So what was after that ended, that incarnation of you and Tom, then what led to getting you guys back together and then forming the Heartbreakers?
Well, we were in L.A., and the Mudcrutch deal with Shelter Records had fallen apart. We didn't know how to make a record. And we were floundering a bit. And Tom was, Shelter Records kept Tom on as a songwriter. And he kind of kept me on as his sidekick. And then one day, Ben Montench, who was from Gainesville, that we had played in Mudcrutch with, he was doing a demo session. It turned out that Ron Blair and Stan Lynch, who were also from Gainesville, were going to play on the session. And Ben invited me down and Tom down, and that's there. We all were in one room, and it was like, okay, Tom just goes, I'll have this. It's my band now. And we went straight into the studio and made that first record. It was that quick, but we were all from the same area. You know, we understood each other. We were all, you know, Floridians and Gainesville grown, so to speak.
Yeah.
And we all just hooked up, you know, it was a connection.
Did it feel a little bit different with this group than when you were together with Tom as Mudcrutch? Like, did you know that there was a different sound or just I don't know, a artistic sensibility that you felt that you had that was different from what you had before?
Yes. Mudcrutch had a bit of a country Burrito Brothers Bergy flavor, which I liked. The Heartbreakers were more rock, more aggressive, more in-your-face intensity. And that's where Tom and I were kind of leaning at that time, you know, to rock out more. And they were certainly a great rock rhythm section.
And then how'd you guys come up with Heartbreakers, Tom Petty and Heartbreakers?
I think that was Tom or Denny Cordell came up with the name Heartbreakers. And it turned out there was another Heartbreakers in New York with a guy named Johnny Thunders. And Tom, we heard about that. And Tom said, oh, those guys, they won't keep the name. They're just a bunch of junkies, which unfortunately was true. And they hadn't copyrighted it. So we thought, you know, that'll be ours.
Yeah, it's worked out okay, right, over the years.
Yeah, we went through a lot of stupid names before we got Heartbreakers, but Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers just had a ring to it, you know?
So then when you were back together, you said you came out with the first album. What was really the breakout moment for you guys? We're going to get into album number three with Damn the Torpedoes,
cool. Of course,
and yeah. Refugee, but you had your first album that led to the second. And so there was already some significant momentum that Mudcrutch didn't have. So what do you attribute that to? Was there the times or was there a specific person who helped you get to that level?
Well, that's a good question. It was, you know, we had a promotion guy named John Scott who helped push our first record. But, you know, honestly, the first two records didn't generate a whole lot of interest. We didn't get a lot of airplay. What really kind of turned it around for us is we got a opening tour in England, opening for Nils Lofgren. Mm-hmm. And we went over there and that's when things started to catch fire. For some reason, the English press liked us a lot and they praised us a lot. And we did that tour and created a buzz, which then spilled over when we came back to the States eventually. But that's when it started to turn around for us. We went to England and played those gigs and we got such a good reception. We started to realize, you know, that maybe this will work.
Yeah. And so is that the kind of the momentum that you had going into album number three, Damn the Torpedoes?
Yeah. Well, we had a little momentum, but not much commercial success at all.
Yeah.
But we wanted to, you know, get a bigger audience. And so we got a producer, Jimmy Iovine, who we liked the sound he had done on a Patti Smith record called Because the Night. We loved his production sound. So we thought if we get that sound and get some good songs, maybe it'll work for us. And it did.
Was your songwriting process together different from albums number one and two?
No. Tom's process with me has always been the same. We write individually and we've never sat down eyeball to eyeball like Lennon McCartney and try to pull things out of the air. I'm not comfortable doing that. I'm a little more insecure. I like to work on my stuff alone and hone it out a little bit. Yeah. And so I would write what I had, and if I liked it, I would give him Tom a tape, and if he liked it, he would write words to it. And that's the way we always worked together, right through the years.
Was there a handoff on lyrics and the music itself, or was there no, did it change at different times?
No, well, my writing at that time was strictly music. I didn't really have an affinity for lyric writing, and Tom was so good. I would rather hear what he would write than me try to come up with something that I didn't like of my own. So I would just give him music. And I had a way of writing my songs and putting guitars in there that left spaces where the vocal might sing in my imagination. You know, this would fit here if he's saying something here.
Yeah.
And more often than not, he would always sing in the right holes and come up with these great lyrics. But it was just a chemistry we had that worked for the two of us.
And is that the way it continued throughout the course of your 50 years together?
Yeah, that's the way we always did it. You know, I would do the music and hand it to him. And as the years went on, decades went on, I had more music than he could deal with, you know, because I'm kind of a writeaholic. And so eventually I started messing around with my own songs because I knew he wouldn't have time to look at them. And then I started developing my own sense of lyrics and character and this and that. But with him, you know, he was so good. I was so lucky to have a lyricist and a singer with that much personality that could take my music and turn it into something better.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
That gets us into Damn the Torpedoes then. And this was 1979. So you're two albums into it. You talked about how the English crowd and press really helped elevate you guys. You're going into the studio with Jimmy Iovine this time, and after Patti Smith, which is, that's a great album. Of course, a legendary album. Can you recall the first, because we're going to get into Refugee. There's so many great songs, but Refugee. Can you recall the first moment that the melody or the music entered your mind, or that you that led to this song?
Yeah. Well, Tom wrote the melody and the lyrics over my chords and my structure. And my structure originally started out, I had a 4-track TAC at home, and I was recording on that and overdubbing to myself. And one day I had my Les Paul, and I wanted to practice playing solos. And I said, I need some chords. So I put some chords on the 4-track, which happened to be the chords to Refugee, which I was inspired by an old Albert King song called Oh Pretty Woman. I like that key, that's sharp minor. I figured that's a good. It's a good key to practice guitar solos on and work on my vibrato and this and that. So I just strung those chords together in that key. And worked out a little bridge in the middle. And then I put that on one channel on the 4-track. And on the other ones, I just practiced solos, just practiced this and that, you know. And I probably, that somewhere in there, I came up with a. It's acoustic guitar, but.
Yeah.
So I was, that's how it, that was the spark of that piece of music. And so I had this demo there, and I put a little bass on it so it sounded like a band. And I had a drum beat from a record. It was called Drum Drops, I think. And it had a beat on there that, and I copied that as my drum track and put the chords and guitars on it. And I thought it had a vibe to it, you know. I didn't know if it was, if Tom would like it. I thought, you know, I'll play it for him. And he came back and wrote those great words and that melody to those chords. He didn't change the music at all, just sang over it. And there it was.
That's pretty amazing. So it's not, Mike, so it sounds like all of that thing that came together for you, it sounds like, pretty quickly, because you were just doing a bunch of things. You were capturing a bunch of different things at the time.
Yeah, I mean, that demo probably took me 30 minutes, you know. I was just having fun with my 4-track at home. And so, but, you know, music is magical. You know, like, where does it come from? Where do these inspirations, these moments of channeling come from? I'm fascinated with that, because I've been so lucky to have these things come through me over the years. And I don't know why. Why me? Or why they happen, but that was just a moment in time that came, and I put it down, and Tom connected with it, and here we are talking about it.
Well, and what you're saying there is so fascinating, because you hear this over and over again, where people don't really understand where something comes from, but it was, you mentioned it really well. It's a moment in time, and you captured it on your 4-track, and then if you hadn't, maybe that would have been lost.
Oh, see, I wasn't even taking it serious as a song. That's what's so cool about it. It was just me having fun. And if you're having fun, usually something good comes out. And I wasn't thinking about anything except I like this guitar key and I'm going to explore it for a while just for my own amusement. And a lot of my songs have been that way, where you're just noodling around, or you have a sketch, a germ of a little idea, and you flesh it out. And it just, this just comes through you. It's the weirdest thing. And I'm addicted to it because it's such a fascinating feeling and a gift, really. And that's what that was. And I think maybe the fact that I wasn't thinking about it, I'm going to write a hit single. I'm going to blow Tom's mind. I didn't have none of those thoughts. Yeah. I want to, you know, blow my own mind, have fun. And so then it turned into something. And I think that maybe that's why that it's there's something special about it, is that it wasn't contrived at all.
So is that kind of the way that you have approached your music throughout your career, where you haven't forced yourself to sit down and, you know, quote unquote, work?
No, I follow the muse. You know, I don't clock in to write from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock. When I feel something, I just let it flow, you know, and I don't put any rules on it. Like, this has to sound like a hit, or this has to have a catchy chorus, or this has to have an amazing lick. I just get into the mode and the muse and just let it happen, you know. And sometimes it sucks. Sometimes I get lucky and I get something good. And I always have fun anyway. Even the ones that suck, I had fun doing them.
Right. Well, okay. So first of all, it was really cool to see you just play that and pick up a guitar mm-hmm. like that. And you handed it over to Tom, and you said he immediately reacted to it. And Do you recall his process for putting lyrics to that particular song, and, you know, how he thought of the word refugee and the lyrics and any of that?
No, that was his isolation. You know, I gave him a cassette, and he went home, and I've heard from his family that he would sit and play the cassette over and over and hum along to it and try to grab a spark of some sort. But the lyric is so powerful, and it's timeless, you know, and it's going on today, you know, and that's what's so beautiful about it, is a lot of people connect with, you know, you gotta, you know, live your life, you know, and don't let the big man push you down, you know, don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom. That was just from his soul. That's where his lyrics were coming from. A very pure place and a place of hope and redemption, you know. And I wasn't there when he wrote the lyrics. He just came in one day and said, oh, I've got these. He played the cassette and sang along with them. That's great. Let's do that. You know, and Jimmy Iovine did a backflip. He heard that, and here comes my girl. And he said, that's all I need. I don't care what else you guys record. Do whatever you want. He said, I've never listened to side two of any album in my life. Those two songs were set. And so, you know, we just all laughed. All right, Jimmy. Okay. But he was right. You know,
he was classic.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So lyrics came easily to Tom.
I don't know. I think they did. Well, I know they did, because sometimes he would make them up in rehearsal. We would start jamming or playing something, and I would know he would start singing something. I knew he hadn't written it down, and it would just come to him, and he would have a rhyme and a structure to it. I think it was just a gift he had. But he did all the songs he wrote to my music. He did in his office when I wasn't there. And like I did the music in my office when he wasn't there. I have great respect for his talent. I was lucky to have a partner like that.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. And I remember, like, here's the thing about music. Like you said, it's so timeless. I remember exactly where I was when I first heard that song. I was in high school driving back from a basketball game. And I can visualize exactly where I was at, and it just was so damn powerful that came out, and it is timeless. You know, people love that song, but that's the thing about your guys' songs, that they're such pure rock and roll that they are timeless songs. So this particular song, you have what you and Tom were very satisfied with. And you've mentioned that Jimmy, you're coming into the studio and he says, that's all you need. That is, you know, the other track.
Yeah.
So how did he, if at all, shape that song from the way you guys were playing it coming into the studio?
Well, the main thing that Jimmy did was get the big sound, big drum sound. But the problem with Refugee, the demo was really good just by accident. It had a groove. It had all the elements of music. And so we went in the studio with Jimmy, and he got this big sound for us, and we went out there and played the chords, and it just didn't feel right. And it took us forever to make that sound feel like the funky little demo I did, just to get the groove and the spark and the vibe of it. And so, you know, but once we did get it, you know, we had the big sound on it, you know, and that was Jimmy and Shelly, his engineer, Shelly Yakas. They worked really hard, you know, I mean, harder than I would ever want to work again on the Sonics, like, you know, 4 days on a snare drum and 6 days on a kick drum and just getting every little minute detail just right, you know. It was a lot of work just to try to recreate a demo.
Yes. I remember watching there was a Springsteen documentary. I think it was Springsteen. and it was Jimmy Iovine in the studio. And Jimmy, it was the first time that he really had a chance to do something in the studio. And I remember they were working, like, he had Bruce Springsteen hitting a, like getting the exact right sound for the drums, like over and over and over again, where everybody else was excited. No, I think it was a, sorry, I think it was a vice versa. It was Springsteen that needed perfection. And Jimmy was in the studio, like falling asleep. And because Bruce was just hitting the drumstick over and over again, that this is the sound he needed.
Well, that's what people may not understand about making records is it's, you don't just walk in and just boom, boom, play it and you're done. Yeah. There's a lot of prep, a lot of technical, meticulous details that you have to work on in the studio to create magic. And sometimes, you know, that hard work works against you because you get so lost in the forest of the sounds and the details that you forget to just relax and play, you know, and perform the song. And that's a lesson that we had to learn the hard way.
Well, when you were in the studio this time with Jimmy then, because you had two albums beforehand, did you feel like it was free and easy in there? Did you feel like relaxed as a band? Or did you feel some pressure that, hey, we got to, we need to get some real success with this album?
Well, no, there was no, Jimmy was, there was no ease in there. It was no well, occasionally we'd be happy-go-lucky if we got lucky and got a track that he liked, but it was tense and it was pressure. And he, you know, Jimmy was driven and Tom was driven and we all were, but Jimmy especially, he felt like, I think he felt like his reputation was on the line. He wanted to have a huge hit record and he wanted to make it the best record anybody's ever heard, you know, and that's putting a high bar for yourself when you go in there. But he pushed us and it wasn't always pretty, you know, but that's the work you have to do to make a great record. And he did make a great record, you know.
And so when you were done with the studio and it was in the can, did you did you guys, before it was released, know you had something here that was at a different level?
Well, Jimmy did. I didn't. I don't think we never knew. We still never know. Are people going to like this? I mean, we did Full Moon Fever and took it to the record company and they said, we don't hear anything. You know, and then six months later, they take the same record and they go, oh, there's five hits on here. Like, so we don't know. We know we like it. Jimmy was excited and Jimmy would fly all over and promote it to the radio stations and this and that. He worked hard to make people aware that this record was out. He wanted it to succeed and he has a lot to do with that, you know. But did we know? No. You never, we were pleasantly surprised when it caught on. But that's just the nature of the business.
Yeah. How did you feel about that? Okay. So the album is launched. You have the first singles come out. Refugee comes out and it just takes off. How does that feel as a musician and just what it does for your life?
It's overwhelming. I mean, we were so blessed. And when I think about it, it's hard to believe that all that came true for us, but it did. And you're just kind of riding a wave. You know, it's like I would look at my wife and go, you know, I think we're going to be okay. I think we can pay the rent this month. And I think we can afford to go out to eat once or twice a week, maybe now, or maybe we can get a nicer car. And then slowly it just started building and we realized we had some financial security. And it's just like the phrase I always use, I would just walk around, look at myself and look around and go, how did I get here?
Yeah.
You know, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. And it's a great feeling. Success feels good. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
To have people love your music and sing it back to you from the stage, it's religious, you know? I mean, I don't know how to describe it. It's the best feeling in the world.
Well, that's the thing. It's got to be pretty amazing that it's amazing enough if somebody has one song that people know around the world and anytime you play it, they're going to be singing to you. That's got to be quite a rush. But when you have just this endless string of songs that you've strung together over the course of your career, yeah, that's got to be an amazing, overwhelming experience to see that. And it goes through generations that if you're playing and you're playing these songs that the young people know it, the, you know, people my age know it, you know, and everybody in between.
How did I get here? I look at it like when you talk about it like that, I don't think about it that much, but it's like I have been very blessed. You know, my life has been very blessed with my music and the success and the fans that love the music and the freedom it's given me to make more music and to have a family and take care of them, provide for them and keep making more music. I mean, it's I don't know what to say about it. It doesn't suck.
It doesn't suck. I bet. Before we get into your memoir, which talks about all these themes, right, of your journey and evolution as an artist, I do want to ask you one thing about, you mentioned Full Moon Fever.
Yeah.
Such a great album. Such a classic album. You wrote Running Down a Dream, among other songs, which is such an amazing song. And then you play guitar. You're doing your vocals. So how does that become, I've always wondered, how does that become a Tom Petty album and not a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers album?
Well, Tom had a contract. I don't know what the details of his contract were, but he was due to turn in a record and he wanted to, and the band was at a point where we could use a break from each other. And he bumped it. It was all organic. He bumped into Jeff and went over, they came over to the house and they wrote a song, came over to my house, we recorded it. Jeff was so the total opposite of Jimmy Iovine in terms of recording. He knew exactly how to get the sound right away. Quick, done, next song, da-da-da. You know, he would come in at noon, and whether it was I Won't Back Down or Running Down a Dream or Free Falling, and we'd have the sketch of the song. We'd start it, the three of us, and by 4 that afternoon, it's done. You know, all the overdubs and everything. And it's like, that's like the, you know, with Jimmy Iovine, we'd be lucky to have the snare drum team by then. God bless him. But it's just a whole different way of making music. But that was really fun. I like doing it fast. It's more fun for me when I do it fast and don't, you know, struggle over the minutia. Yeah.
And for everybody out there, when Mike mentions Jeff, that's Jeff Lynn from ELO. Mm, right. And was that the first album that Jeff produced for you guys?
Yeah, we did 2 with them, with the band. Well, we did 2, 3. That was the first one that was Tom's first solo record, Full Moon Fever, which I co-produced and helped record and worked on with them. And then the next album we did with Jeff was Into the Great Wide Open, which we wanted to bring the band into that technique and try to get the two worlds to fit, which we did. And then later on, Tom did another solo record, Highway Companion, which we did at Jeff's house, the three of us. I helped him with that too. And we did 3 with Jeff. Yeah.
I have to mention one thing that just came to me because I followed your journey throughout all these years. I love the music. Mm-hmm. So Into the Great Wide Open, that song, I remember somebody, it might've been you, who mentioned that, who called that song Refallen. And I forgot who that was. It might've been Stan.
It had to be Stan. I wouldn't say something like that.
Yeah, I think that's what he said, Dad. But it sticks with me. But
yeah,
anyhow,
he's a funny guy.
So, Mike, you have now a new memoir, Heartbreaker.
Yeah.
Which talks about your storied life and your music journey, your journey with Tom. I'm curious, why was this the right time for you to write this book?
Well, I don't know if it was the right time. It just came to me. I didn't have an agenda to write a book. I was just making music, and through Jan Uhelski, the journalist from Cream Magazine, and a friend of hers, they approached me and said, Ari Serdaval, who is the ghostwriter in the book, would be interested in writing a book about your life. And I said, why? You know, and she said, well, you know, there's a lot of musician books. And she said, well, yeah, but I think your story is more unique. So they talked me into it. And that's how it came about. It wasn't, I don't like the word memoir. I mean, that sounds like you're dead, you know, like I just call it my book, you know, I mean, it is about my life. It does cover my whole life though. So I guess you can call it a memoir, but that word always triggers me somehow.
Was that fun to do? Was it easy to do?
It was interesting. It was an interesting experience on a lot of levels. It was fun because I didn't have to do much work. I just talked like I'm talking to you and would tell Ari the memories that popped into my head. Some of them I didn't even know were still in there, but they started coming out of my mind, and he recorded it, and then he went back and put it together in a manner that you could read it, that made sense, and put a cadence to it. He did a great job. I mean, I couldn't have done it without him. But it was fun for me because I just talked, you know, and reminisced. And some of it was painful, remembering certain people in my life that are gone and hardships that I had. Some of those were hard to remember, but mostly it was joyful, you know. And I felt, aside from feeling old, I felt that, yeah, it really is quite an interesting life. It's not your normal musician life. I mean, I crossed paths with a lot of amazing people and had a lot of amazing things happen to me that I think are interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So no question that you crossed paths with a lot of amazing musicians and people in general. And again, the list is too long, but is there any particular collaboration or experience you had with an artist who wasn't Tom, your partner, that sticks out to you, that was really special to you?
Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is a huge influence and hero of mine. Now you were talking earlier about hearing Refugee the first time. I remember the first time I heard Like a Rolling Stone. I was sitting in a cafe with a hamburger. It was playing on the speakers. I could smell it. I was in that moment and it affected me. So I know what you're talking about. But Bob Dylan came into our life and we toured the world with him, made a few recordings here and there. And I don't know, you know, I don't want to say he's better than some of the other people I've worked with as an influencer or inspiration, but he's right up there. And he's just a fascinating genius. And just being around him was very awe-inspiring.
And when you were conjuring up these memories for your new book, how would you describe how your relationship with Tom evolved over those decades?
Well, I hope it kept getting better. I mean, it's interesting because our first album, still one of my favorite albums, you know, those songs, American Girl, Breakdown, and Rocking Around With You. But as the years went on, we wrote a lot of songs, you know, and we just kept trying to get better, you know, and I think sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't. But we just enjoyed what we were doing, you know, and it just evolved organically. We kept writing the way we do, with me working on music and him writing words to it, or him bringing in a song and me helping embellish it, you know, to bring it to life for him. We were going to do more records, you know, that was our plan, was, you know, we'll finish this tour, the last tour, and then we'll make another record and go play that one too. So we were going on and on. It just was a very strong partnership. It just kept evolving with time.
I remember, I forgot exactly what month it was, but I was in the audience for one of your final tours or your final concerts when it was at Kabu, that music festival that was down in San Diego. And then I had seen you guys before at Arroyo Seco, I think it was, outside the Rose Bowl. And that was I remember it was that same year, those two concerts. And like, what a shocker that was, obviously, for everybody. So I can't imagine, but I'm sure your book gets into just all of the feelings and all of that with your journey with Tom.
Yeah, you know, it's been a little over 7 years now. And I want to make clear that it wasn't like I decided, like, I've got to write this book about Tom's life and me and him. And it was never that my ambition at all to share any of that information with anybody. It was personal. But since it came to me and I did it, it wasn't planned at this time or any other time that I should do it or shouldn't do it. It just kind of came up and I dove into it. But, you know, it's like I said, it's been a little over 7 years now. It's a long time, you know, to lose your best friend. And I just keep on making music, you know.
Yeah, and keep touring. And you're going on you're touring this year with your band.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is it about this band and the sound that you have here? How would you describe it as a different kind of feeling or ethos than what you had in your music with Tom and the rest of the guys in Heartbreakers?
Well, the Dirty Knobs is my band now, and they're similar to the Heartbreakers because I'm playing guitar and writing the songs and now singing them. But the Dirty Knobs compared to the Heartbreakers, I won't say more hard rocking, but a little more edgy, maybe more turned up a little bit. And It's just fun, you know. It's all about fun for me now. I love playing with these guys, and they play. Yeah. They learn the songs really quick. We don't slave over them. I show it to them in the studio once or twice, and go on to the next song.
Yeah.
And they support me, and they're great musicians, and we just have a joy, you know. We go out and play, and we've got a good audience that's been showing up now. We're playing little theaters, and to me, that's success, you know.
Well, yeah. Look, when you get to do what you're doing, and it's all for love of the game, and you get to do it completely your way, that's a good way to live.
Yeah. How did I get here?
You're a good guy. You're a talented guy. Man. That's how it happens. And like you said, there's so many things that come together that you can't even define. There's so many things that come together for anybody to have the life that they do. I'm going to ask you some lightning round questions.
Oh, boy.
Okay, I got. What's your favorite song that you've ever written?
It's so hard, but maybe Here Comes My Girl.
That's a great song. Love that song. And what is one of your most memorable moments as an artist?
Yeah, this was a big moment for me, and it was after a Heartbreakers European tour, and we had met George Harrison, and he was going to do a benefit show at Royal Albert Hall the week after the Heartbreakers tour ended. And he asked me to play on the show with him. And so that's where I met Steve Ferrone, was at that gig. So I went and learned the set with that band, great band that George put together. And we played Royal Albert Hall, all those great George Harrison songs. And I was like 10 feet off the ground. And then at the end, Ringo came out and played with us. And it was just like, wow, you know, that's a moment I won't never forget.
So as an artist who is as accomplished as you have, and you've played with everybody, is there ever a moment that even you get a little bit nervous, like this guy, you know, this person?
All the time. I mean, with people like Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, George Harrison, Roy Orbison, that's always the first impression. It's like, oh my God, it's them, you know? But then as a musician, once you get over that initial awe-inspiring reaction, you just get down to, you know, getting one-on-one as musicians communicating. And that was the same with all those guys. You know, once I got over the fact that I was awestruck, it was a beautiful experience.
And right now, are there any particular musicians, old or new, that you really respect for their sound or for whatever reason, but just as artists, who sticks out for you today?
Well, new or old?
It could be anybody who you just as you sit here that you really respect, or I'll ask it this way. Who's on your playlist these days, your own personal playlist?
Okay. Well, once again, Bob Dylan. I always go back and listen to Bob Dylan. I liked a lot of the old songs, and I liked the new songs too. He's always inspiring to me, you know. Of course, the stuff that I listen to on my playlist, I listen to new stuff when I can, but I end up stopping it usually before the song's over, and I'll go, you know, go get that Beatles second album. I'd rather hear that, you know. Yeah. I go back to the stuff that turned me on at the beginning, you know, the Stones, you know, Paul Butterfield, the Beatles, the Beach Boys. That's the stuff. If I really want to sit back and listen to music and not be sucked into writing something, and I want to just enjoy it, that's the stuff I gravitate toward.
Any current rock and roll, like new guys that are out there just on the rock and roll scene?
I like this band called Dawes. They're pretty good.
Yeah.
There's a younger band that I don't know that well, but they're called Starcrawler. They have a girl singer that they did a version of I Need to Know that was pretty good. Yeah, but I have trouble with a lot of the new music because it just doesn't speak to me, you know?
Yeah. With all the things that you've done up to this point in time, and now you have this new book coming out. You're touring right now with Dirty Knobs, your band there. Is there anything on your bucket list that really drives you, that, okay, I've accomplished all these things, but there's still these things that I'd like to do?
You know, I can honestly say I've never been asked that question, but I think my bucket list has been answered. I mean, I just want to, I don't have any huge ambitions. I don't need to play Madison Square Garden. I don't need to play the US Festival. I don't need to play for thousands of people. I've worked with most of the people that I know, that I respect. I've done that. I mean, what I would just like to do is keep the Dirty Knobs going, you know, maybe get up to a little bit bigger theaters and just keep having fun doing that. I mean, that's the only bucket list I got left.
Yeah.
And that, and my family, you know, watch my family grow and my kids and all that.
Yeah. No, of course. Great stuff. Mike, listen, really good to have you. Everybody go out and see the Dirty Knobs on tour. They're on tour. His new book that is out in March. And then just all the great music. Thanks so much for joining the Story Behind the Song and taking us through all of that. What a great catalog of stuff that you've built and just all the journey that you've had.
Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate that. Good interview. I liked your questions. And thanks for mentioning the Dirty Knobs in the book. And that's what it's all about right now.
That was legendary guitarist Mike Campbell of the great band Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers telling his story behind the band's classic breakout track, Refugee. I'm your host, Peter Chatti of Deep Cuts Media. You can find me at deepcutsmedia.com. If you like my podcast, please rate it, follow it, and share it with your friends, family, and other music fans like you. And make sure you follow the Consequence Podcast Network to keep up to date with all our series at consequence.net/consequence-podcast-network. Thanks for listening to the kickoff of Season 4. Stay tuned for a great season of new interviews with music icons like Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo, Susanna Hoffs of the Bengals, Adam Duritz of Counting Crows, and Nancy Wilson of Heart, who's my first two-timer, mixed with classic interviews of legendary artists that you can find in The Vault, which now holds over 60 interviews from Seasons 1, 2, and 3. The artists are legendary, their stories are classic and timeless, and they'll come to you every Monday morning. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.